Hi, everyone. Thank you for joining the Life After Love Gone Wrong podcast. I have a special guest with me today, Dr. Christine Cocciola, who is an expert in coercive control and has her own practice, Coercive Control Consulting. She also runs some parenting groups, and she does have her own podcast that she'll share with us in a bit. Thank you so much, Dr. Cocciola, for being with us today. I really appreciate it, and I'm excited to talk to you about some of these really important topics.
Thank you, Sandra, for having me here. I appreciate it, too.
I actually was introduced to Dr. Cocciola. We did a seminar together revolving around the narcissist and coercive control and abusive relationships, and I had an opportunity to hear her speak, and I invited her to join us today because what she really specializes is how coercive control, how these relationships affect children. And I wanted to kind of give that perspective because I know that I have other episodes that talk about coercive control and how that manifests itself in a courtroom, how you can do some things to kind of protect yourself from a legal perspective, what a abused spouse looks like and how they may manifest some of that. But this is really special because it talks about what happens to a child or children who are in these types of relationships. And as I mentioned to Dr. Cocciola earlier when we were preparing for our call today, that I feel, at least in my practice, that some of the things that the courts are really not grasping or always really understanding is, well, a few things. One is how, even though an abused spouse, parent, who may have left physically the dynamic, can still manifest signs of their trauma for quite a period of time afterwards, because it takes a lot of hard work to kind of move forward from this type of relationship. And then also how that parent may manifest to the court, right, as the protective parent, when a child or children are still spending time and having to go see the abusive spouse. And then also kind of some of the things that children do that a parent may be trying to explain to the court, and the courts are either dismissing or not fully understanding why this is happening or how to help, more importantly, a child or children in this dynamic. So, Dr. Cocciola, let's start with kind of the things that you see in children who are part of a dynamic where there is coercive control.
Sure. So I think it's important to highlight, right, this idea of what coercive control is. And so when we think of coercive control, what we have to understand is it's the underpinning of all abuse, literally all abuse. I see it in the micro way, meaning in intimate relationships. I see it with systems. You said you've had people on to talk about courts and agencies and how we can coerce and control people to behave a certain way. And unfortunately, that sometimes, oftentimes harms them, right? But also in the macro way related to policy and how governments actually may create policies that marginalize certain groups of people. And so for me, when I think of coercive control, I really want to have your listeners see it in this way, that just because there may not be physical violence, it doesn't mean that it's not abuse. And that oftentimes when relationships start off in this way, where there is someone coercing and controlling them, that in that, eventually what we know is those are the most risky behaviors. Those are the ones that become the most violent. So when it comes to children living in these family systems, it's really important to understand whether they are in a family system where someone is using physical violence or not, whether they're experiencing physical violence or not. It is about coercion and control, and it is an unacknowledged child abuse. None of the systems, the children living in a home where one person is exerting power and control over another, are actually experiencing abuse. Yet the research affirms for us that these children are suffering traumatic experiences. And so What I would say about the traumatic experiences is that they don't always manifest in a way that seem problematic. When we have trauma in our life, we often respond in a way that is fight, like we might have fight or aggression or really angry a lot. Well, when we see that in people, we're like, wow, what's going on with that person? So certainly
Right.
when we see that in children, we're like, oh, something's going on with that kid, right? Except that what's interesting to me is that if you see a kid who's behaving this way, and I've worked in schools for years, when we see children having these kinds of behaviors, we aren't asking the question, what is really going on in the family system that might make a child need to cope in a way that feels aggressive? And so that fight is a trauma response, but also flight is a trauma response. And flight is a child who maybe is a perfectionist, a child who's getting straight A's, a child who does all their homework, is always following the rules, is doing whatever they can to prove themselves in the world. That is also a trauma response. So is freeze, dissociation, maybe really being hyper-focused on video games or technology, or whether it's a sport, that may be, in a way, a coping mechanism for children. And certainly for adults, too, but specifically we're talking about children. And then, of course, fawn, when we just literally go along with what other people tell us to do, even if we don't agree with it. So I think what I'm trying to say is that trauma can manifest in a variety of ways. We make assumptions when we see a child who's aggressive that maybe there's something going on, but we even don't often look deeply. I'm trying to suggest that there's a lot of ways the trauma can show up, and the four major ways I just described. And what is really going on in that home? Just because somebody is coming from a family system where maybe the father's an attorney and the mother is a social worker, we'll say, and they seem like a good family. Everything seems really great because nobody's coming to school with bruises. Nobody's, the mother or the other part, whoever it isn't going to the police. That doesn't mean that in that family system, there's not one person exerting power and control over the other person. And in that, this hidden abuse that we don't see all the time, in that, children learn very early on to regulate their behavior.
What do you mean by regulate?
Yes. So regulating behavior means I am, well, an easy way to say it, Sandra, is walking on eggshells. I learned that in my home, if I see dad's car there, that I have to behave a different way. And I learned that if I hear loud noises coming from the bedroom, that I have to be like some yelling or something that sounds angry. I learned that I need to behave a certain way. I learned to maybe come in and try to intervene so that things don't get as bad. One of the most significant things I think these children learn is that they don't feel safe. Even if they have a safe parent, they don't feel safe in this environment because usually there's a couple of things going on. One, that parent who is a safe parent isn't able to advocate for themselves. They don't have agency in their life. They don't have the ability to create boundaries. They are walking on eggshells all of the time. So the children learn that they need to walk on eggshells. So there's a feeling of unsafety because of that, but there's also a feeling of unsafety because if a perpetrating parent, this harmful parent, is aggressive, then of course the kids are learning to be small in the home, right? They're learning to be very tiny, small in the home. They can't be themselves. They cannot be authentically who they really are. If this parent is a permissive parent, they get to do whatever they want with this parent. They also learn that if they don't follow the rules of this parent, then this parent might become angry. So in this, a child learns that they can't be themselves. They just simply are not feeling safe with the protective parent, and they're not feeling safe, of course, with the abuser. So they begin to hide how they really feel, and they begin to realize that the love that they're getting is conditional. Now, maybe not from the protective parent. Thankfully, oftentimes these children recognize that the love from the protective parent is unconditional, but they also recognize that it's not safe. That protective parent cannot be authentic herself I'm using her, but she can't authentically be herself. So the children are understanding that they cannot authentically be themselves either.
Let me interrupt you because I have a question.
Sure, please.
In my head, if you're a child who has grown up and this has been the dynamic in your home your entire life, at what age do they start to, I don't know, wonder, understand, question whether or not this is normal? Because I think sometimes, for example, when the manifestation fight, you have a child who's aggressive. And so the parents will say, well, they've had troubles in school with aggression since kindergarten or second grade or first grade. And now it is minimized because to say that's a response to what's going on in the home because of an abusive parent, everybody doesn't really understand that in fact could be true based on what you just said. I think that's what you just said. Because of the abuse and it's just not being called into question until now that there's actually a legal situation that's pending.
Right. Yeah. So I think when you ask what age, I think you're going to actually flip this just for a moment. What I suggest okay. is that if I'm an abuser, and yes. I have chosen my partner. And the reason why I chose my partner is because, frankly, my partner has what Sandra Brown talks about, what lots of research talks about, is that victims and survivors have, they're highly empathic. They tend to be givers in relationship. They tend to be loyal to a fault and certainly fixers. They're agreeable, conscientious. So I've chosen this adult victim. And now we have children together. And mm-hmm. I recognize, now remember, abusers don't just become abusers. They've been abusers. They just do a really good job of hiding it, right? Until they're feeling so. So now we have children and I realize I'm the perpetrator, how much my partner loves these children and how important they are to her. I believe that abusers start day one to watch carefully how they can actually use the children in a way that oppresses the protective parent. So they start at a very early day one with the children to get the children to see the protective parent just not entirely in the same light that protective parent should be seen in. It doesn't mean that they, you know, stop the children from loving the protective parent, but they may use diminishing comments, undermining in some way, so that if and when that protective parent decides to escape, the abuser is able to readily get the children to align with them. So to your question, when do children finally get it? I think it's really tricky. It depends on quite a few things. It depends on how attached, how strong that attachment is to the protective parent. And if that abuser has started day one to what I call maliciously fracture that attachment, to undermine the relationship, to counter parent, to be the permissive parent and let the protective parent be the one that makes the children do their homework, if that abuser is behaving in that way, then it's going to be really hard for a child to get it. It's going to be really hard unless that protective parent gives them clarity and says, wow, that behavior was inappropriate. I don't appreciate when they start calling out the abuser's behavior. But oftentimes, as victims are like living in a fog, they don't even see it as right. abusive until it's like way abusive, until they're in family court sometimes, until custody comes up. And so I think the children who get clarity on this are the children who oftentimes are dealing with a more aggressive perpetrator, because it's hard when abuse is physical or screaming and yelling, when there's a lot of name calling, oftentimes it's easy for children to see this is frightening, this is scary, I don't like it. And in that, they have a little more clarity. But I'll give you a story. I have a mom who's 12-year-old, witnessed the mother get physically assaulted after years of, again, coercive control started from day one. So after years of coercive control, there was a physical incident. The child calls the police, dials 911. Right. The police come. The father yanks the phone out of the child's hand and punches the child for doing this, right? So the child has this incident. The child is now 15 and aligned with the abusive parent. Mm-hmm. We ask why. Because there has been so much work for so long, since day one again, where this abusive parent has done things to diminish the protective parent. And if the protective parent is none the wiser that this is going on, then it's easy for these children to say, all right, either she's crazy, she's the problem, and also, just like the victim has, Cognitive dissonance. These children forget the frightening experiences, or they are so afraid of the frightening experiences that they align. They align out of fear, always, but they align out of fear of the abuser, or they align out of fear of the abuser rejecting them. They align out of fear that maybe the protective parent isn't who they think they are. So there's a lot of dynamics in all of this. And I think the most important thing for your listeners to hear is that just like they were trauma bonded to this person, they had an attachment to this person who now they look back and they say, oh my gosh, he was so harmful. Oh my gosh, I can't believe I stayed so long. Oh my gosh, I should have, like, they are doing all these things, right? Like these, I wish I left sooner. Well, it's hard to leave sooner when you're at, we always talk about this. I use this quote Dr. Evan Stark uses. He was on my doctoral committee and he is a mentor of mine. And he says, coercive control is like carpenter ants devouring the foundation of your house. You don't even know it's happening until it's too late.
Right. That's a great quote.
It's profound. And so now let's add the next layer. You didn't know it was happening. And we expect children to get it. We expect them to get it when their brains have been so, these coercive controllers want their children to feel unstable in their footing. So that way they're more easily able to be controlled. That's how I control you. That's how I control the adult victim. If I'm a perpetrator, I control the adult victim by creating this undermining of you as a human being, as a mother, as an employee, whatever it is. I in some ways diminished you so that you didn't have as much agency, and we call it perspecticide. You lost your ability to know what you should know. If this relationship was anybody else in the world, you would have been able to say, oh my gosh, this is crazy, get out of there. But because it's in your own world, we lose perspective. And in that, of course, our children lose perspective. This is their parent.
Right. So
I call it broken brain. Children who grow up in these family systems end up having their brains are traumatized. They have their brains have changed, and we are parenting different children because of it. And that is the basis of my work, is how do we parent these children who are not just, quote unquote, just trauma victims. They are trauma victims of something that no one in the world even acknowledges as traumatic.
And so if you are in a legal process, and whether you're a judge or an arbitrator or an attorney representing a victim, how do you explain this type of behavior and these issues to a court? I mean, I imagine, right, that of course there's probably a plethora of research in the medical community about this, but how do you get them to focus on what the child needs? Because oftentimes you will hear, right, the standard response to this from the abuser is, this is parental alienation.
Right.
And because you have two, I'm going to call them flagrant sets of accusations being tossed around in a legal proceeding, right? One person is saying this person's an abuser. They use coercive control. They're not safe. The other person is saying, well, that parent's a parental alienator and I have legal rights to my child. And they're trying to prevent that relationship happening and using the legal system to do that. And what we all know is that coercive controllers, abusers who use this tactic, they will use it through the court system, right? They will perpetually drag on a case. They will file excessive pleadings and there will be a lot of motion practice, and they will keep the victim kind of intertwined, and the family, frankly, intertwined in the system for as long as possible as a way to continue to exact that kind of control over these parties, right?
Right. Very much so. So how do we, I mean, I think it's a tricky thing. I think the reality is we live in a world where we think that children need two parents. We live in a world where we think that fathers, no matter what they've done, I mean, I have a mom, a significant case out of Pennsylvania where father did something so harmful and was arrested, and the children don't want to go to visit him because they witnessed the whole event. It's on camera. There's no
No
discrepancy here.
questions,
No
right?
question about whether or not it happened. And the mom is being told if she doesn't make the children at 12 and 14 to get in the car to go to see a repair therapist so that they can have therapy and be in the same room with an abusive person, that she will be called an alienator. So this is just, the system is really not supporting the welfare of children. It literally
Exactly.
sees children. Yeah, children are seen as insignificant in this. And the reality, we always talk about this, right? If I am stalked, right, it's considered egregious. But if my partner stalks me, it's not the same, right? We treat people differently when it's happening with a stranger, and we're doing the same thing to our children. Children do not need two parents. They do not. I'm telling you from a psychological perspective, from a trauma perspective, they need one healthy, loving parent. That's what they need. And so I talk about three different ways that children go in these kinds of family systems. Sometimes they align with the abuser, which is absolutely devastating. Sometimes they might have a relationship with the abuser, but with some boundaries in place. And some children
Right.
totally don't want anything to do with the abuser. And if you don't want to have anything to do with the abuser, then you're going to be accused of alienation as a parent. And that is just the most heartbreaking thing to me, because those children who don't want anything to do with an abuser are children who are exerting their personal power. They're actually
Right.
saying, I need
Their
to consent to
autonomy.
this. Exactly. Yet the courts punish them for this.
Correct. And you said it exactly right. What the court, at least in my experience, what the legal response is to put children in these reunification therapies, these programs, there's camps. I mean, it's mind-blowing to anybody who's outside of this process to say, what is happening? But that's exactly what's happening. Children who are repeatedly saying, I don't want to do this, I don't feel safe, I don't want to go. A victim who's trying to allay all of the issues that are happening. And even in that example you gave, where there's documented video evidence, there is this belief that is prevalent that just because a parent abused another parent doesn't mean that they're going to be doing that to their children, or doesn't mean that they're not safe to be around their kids. And there's this total missing or lack of understanding or just complete ignorance on the fact that in these types of, you said coercive control is all of it. And when you have an abusive situation, whether it's one time or 100 times, forcing a child and a parent to have a relationship that's not healthy allows that abuser to continue to cause havoc on this family dynamic. And then you have children growing into adults and they're repeating these patterns.
Yeah.
Or, am I wrong?
Well, repeating it or fawning, getting in almost, well, when you don't have agency in your own developing life, right? You learn that you can't have agency elsewhere, or you exert power and control because you feel so out of control. I mean, there's a whole discussion that we could have about how do abusers become who they are. And it's really this idea of shame, and that they exert that shame onto other people. And so what we don't want is our children growing up with an abuser, because we don't want more abusers and we don't want more
Right.
victims. And so how do we prevent that? We prevent the intergenerational trauma by keeping children safe from these types of circumstances. And just as a little aside, I have a mom right now who is the protective parent and wants repair therapy with her children because the abuser has alienated her. Right? And
yes.
This is something that can happen, and it happens all too often. But what I say to these moms or whoever the protective parent is that if you force your child, they're never going to feel like they had the ability to make the choice. We can do other things to make them feel safe, but forcing them into therapy with you is not, they already have a false narrative about you. They already have
Right.
these ideas about you, and now you're forcing them. Those ideas are not going to go away. They are just not going to go away. So the point is that forcing anyone, I mean, conversion therapy, it's all BS, right? Any of these types
Right.
of things that are just so harmful to children. And I have another mom who the father abused a year ago, but now he's been in therapy, and everybody assumes,
Right.
the court is assuming he's better. These people don't ever get better. They don't. They just get savvier, but they don't get better.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's really, the travesty really falls on these children and people like you, and talking about it, bringing awareness. And you said before that this is pervasive and it's not going to change. There are some states, and I know in the UK in particular, I believe the UK or Australia might have started this change, this systemic change, I will say, where they have adopted acts. I know California has one now that says that if their abuse is found to a parent, then it is assumed to the child, and it allows judges and arbitrators and the system to take an extra step to protect children who are in these situations.
I think what we're talking about is like Peakey's Law and Kaden's Law and these laws that are actually saying that court professionals need to be trained on domestic, quote unquote, violence. I think the issue that is concerning to me is who's going to be doing these trainings, and do they actually talk about, so it's coercive control is really about looking beyond the violent incident model. We've archaically continued to look at abuse as through the violent incident model, and that is not appropriate. Abuse is always about power and control. And so my hope is, I mean, I'm so excited about these laws, no question about it. I mean, I've been teaching social work and on the college level for over 25 years or so. And the reality is that we have never had anything in the books regarding custody and children and safety. And so now we have that, but we do need court professionals to be trained adequately and to actually then use these laws. So that's a whole other conversation.
And not to be scared. I mean, that's exactly it. But I think the first step is having something in place that they can rely on as the people who are making decisions. And listen, I personally think that being a judge is, especially a family court judge or professional, is a career of dedication and empathy. You are really charged with making serious decisions about people's personal lives. And I think that they don't want to get it wrong, per se, but having the right training and having laws that allow them to kind of do more than what they're currently doing is moving steps in the right direction. But, you know, we're moving slowly, and that is frustrating when you are in the system, whether you're an advocate, a professional like yourself, or obviously a victim in a family going through it. We've run out of our time for today. This is, I mean, I feel like you and I could probably like talk for hours about this because there's so much to discuss and go through. So definitely I look forward to having you back, Dr. Cocciola. And I know that you mentioned that you do have a podcast as well. Can you just share the name of that?
Sure. It's called Perfect Prey because I think that these abusers choose their victims and they're very selective. And I believe children are obviously the perfect prey of these abusers. And I have a protective parenting program that is for parents who are trying to navigate parenting these children who are so harmed by these abusers. It's a tricky thing. And it takes a different type of parenting. It truly does. And so I appreciate you having me on, and I appreciate all the work you do and the education you do. And I would love to come back and we can continue. We could do part 2, 3, and 4 of this conversation.
Truly. I believe that is the case. And, you know, and I want to say that for any listener who is in this situation, that you should definitely get as much information and look at all the resources and educate yourself to the extent that you can, as much as you possibly can, and to find professionals that you are working with that are also knowledgeable about these types of issues, because not every therapist, not every attorney, not, you know, all of those people, they're not necessarily having the same expertise in this particular area as others may. So do your homework, be your own advocate, which is hard, but at the very least, you can choose for yourself professionals that can help you. And there is a way to get through this and to the other side in a healthy way, but you have to just be an active participant in some of this, a lot of this, I should say. And it starts, in my opinion, in making those types of decisions. So check out these resources, my podcast is Life After Love Gone Wrong, and then Dr. Cocciola has her podcast. And again, I look forward to speaking with you in the future to continue this conversation.
Thank you, Sandra, so much for having me.
You're welcome. Bye, everyone. Thanks for joining in.